I'd like you to open your Bibles this morning to Genesis chapter 18. And let's just take up this theme of the angels standing by. We're going this morning, brethren and sisters, to move to the very personal matter of our individual angels. And we're going to change our program a little bit to actually have, we hope, two studies upon this particular theme. I want you to notice in Genesis 18 and verse 2, and again I don't know this actually struck you as you read it, but it says there in verse 1, "And Yahweh appeared unto him," that is Abraham, "in the plains of Mamre, and he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day. And he lifted up his eyes, and lo, three men stood by him." You ever noticed that before? That's your key to angels. Three men stood by him. And we're going to talk about this morning those that stand by. Zechariah 3, the angel said, "If you are faithful, I will give you a right of access to walk amongst these that stand by." And that is the great mission. That's the pinnacle of the angel's work, is to stand by the throne of God, to await his orders, and to stand by the saints, that they might minister to them. So we find all these references that indicate that the angels stand by. They came and they stood. And they are those that God sends forth to stand by. So we find that the work of the angels is outlined very clearly to us in Exodus 23 verse 20, Genesis 28 verse 15, and Hebrews 1 and verse 14. We've seen this before, "I will keep thee in the way and to bring thee into the place that I have prepared. I am with thee," said the angel in Genesis 28, "I will keep thee in all places whither thou goest, and I will bring thee again to this land, for I will not leave thee." And the angel was standing by, "I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken of." And based upon that, upon the words given to Jacob, to the heir of salvation, Paul says, "Are they not all ministering servants, ministering spirits, sent forth to serve for those who shall be the heirs of salvation?" And Yahweh sends forth his angels to stand by the saints in the earth, to keep them in the way and to bring them into the land. I'd like you to turn up now Isaiah 63, and let's just see what this meant to the Yahweh angel. Now, he's the greatest of the angels, and he was sent to look after Israel in the wilderness. In Isaiah 63, we have this phrase that is used of the Yahweh angel. Isaiah 63 and verse 9. It says, "In all their affliction, he was afflicted." Speaking of God. God is their Saviour in verse 8. God who felt for the children of Israel, "in all their affliction, he," that is God, "was afflicted, and the angel of his presence saved them. In his love and in his pity he redeemed them and bare them and carried them all the days of old." But notice there that in all their affliction he was afflicted. He said to Moses, "I have seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and I am come down to deliver them." And we've got a seated angel speaking and expressing the emotions of God, but were also his own emotions, because they are totally in harmony with God. "We've seen your affliction, we understand. We're here to feel with you the sufferings of Israel, to know your pain." And brethren and sisters, we have to believe that the angels of God are just as active today as ever they were in the past. We're going to consider two of these verses and come back in our next study tomorrow, God willing, to consider Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 9. But I just want you to notice that in all of these verses, there is the absolute assurance that we have an individual angel. We teach our little children that God sees all things, that God knows all things that happen in the earth. It's rather a strange thing that the older we get, that the less we seem to believe it ourselves. We come to think that our lives are so insignificant, so unimportant to God and his great and mighty works, that would he waste an angel on us? Well, God says he assigns angels to individual saints. And for them, it is a very great privilege. We find in Matthew 18 verse 10 that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven. Psalm 34, the angel of the Lord encamps around those that fear him. And in Zechariah chapter 4 and verse 9, the angel comes to Zerubbabel and says, look, you think you're in trouble now. You think you've got mountains of difficulties to worry about now. But Zerubbabel, you will finish the work. You will complete the house. You will overcome, Zerubbabel. And in the kingdom, you will finally appreciate that Yahweh sent me unto you. You will finally really believe that in the kingdom, that Yahweh sent me unto you. I know you don't really believe it now, he says, but you will come to believe that. And twice in Zechariah's prophecy, that statement is made. When all these things are finished, then you will understand that Yahweh did send me unto you. And it's that believing we have to do, brethren and sisters, to realize that it is a privilege for the angels to serve the saints. We know how many angels there are. Christ said, I could just have 72,000 that could come with Gabriel, just like that. At any stage of life, apart from perhaps the first century, when it's estimated there might have been 100,000 believers, you tell me any other time since the coming of Christ that there's been more than a few thousand of the chosen seed on the earth. And when you compare how many Christadelphians, even today, in this latter-day revival of the truth, I estimate there's about 25,000 Christadelphians in the world. It's a great privilege for an angel, from all that great heavenly host of myriads of myriads upon 10,000 times 10,000 of angels. What a privilege for an angel to be said, well, you can have the privilege of guiding this child of God from the cradle to the grave. It's a great part of their reward to have that privilege, that they can work with God to make a child for his kingdom. In some ages, like the days of Daniel, there must have been very, very few that they could work with. There was only the good figs in Babylon that they could really identify with. That's why they came to Daniel and said, oh man, greatly beloved, there's not many like you that want to understand. I am come for thy words. They've always rejoiced to see the few who took an interest in the things that they were trying to reveal. And so God says to the angels, you can be my eyes and ears in the earth. Now God, through his Spirit, knows all things. But he said to the angels that as part of your reward, you can go out and be my eyes and ears, and you come back and tell me what you're seeing happening. And these words in the 2nd of Chronicles 16 and verse 9 were spoken to King Asa. We're told that King Asa failed to trust. When he was put under pressure by the surrounding nations, he went and he hired armies from Syria. And the prophet Hananiah came to him and said, Asa, you've done very, very foolishly in going to the nations for help. You should have put your trust in God, for the eyes of Yahweh run to and fro throughout the earth. And that is a phrase that is used of the angels. Zechariah 1 verse 10, these are those that Yahweh has sent to and fro through the earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is perfect or upright towards him. If you're trying to do the right thing by God and you put your trust in him, his eyes are everywhere present to watch over you. Proverbs 15 verse 3, the eyes of Yahweh are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. The angels are called the watchers, even the holy ones, that God sends to walk to and fro through the earth. And their desire is to work for us. And that's what they were sent forth. And Asa failed to trust. And so we have to come to grips with this concept that God does send his angels to encamp around us. When we're first faced with that thought and we try and get our minds around it, that God actually cares enough to give us an angel, I guess there's a number of emotions that can come into our hearts. It probably depends where we are in our spiritual maturity, how we view that situation. When I was young, I remember having this incredible sense of how much God was watching everything that I not only did but thought, and that the angel was right there. And I guess when we're immature, our first reaction is one of fear and of guilt. And we need to come to realise that the angels are not judges, nor are they sent to be spies or policemen. They are sent to serve. Their entire concern is that we grow spiritually, that we become suitable for the grace of God to enter into life. And their mission is to care, to assist, and to correct, and to save us, not to have us rejected. They are utterly dedicated to our salvation and our eternal benefit. They have nothing for us but goodwill. They do not want to see us fail. We are their brethren, who they want to see in the kingdom. Oh, how we must frustrate them sometimes, brethren and sisters, with our half-hearted ways, with our lack of trust that their eyes are everywhere present to see. Let's just examine Hebrews chapter 1 a little more closely. Are they not all ministering spirits? Now, Paul in Hebrews 1 is actually making the point that Christ as a son sits at God's right hand. He's a son by inheritance. He's more excellent than the angels. But in passing, he makes the observation that the angels are really servants. We'll be happy to serve in the kingdom, won't we? We would love to serve God through eternity. But they are servants, sent forth to serve. So you see that the word ministering means that they are public servants. They are there for the good, to minister for them who shall be the heirs of salvation. So that's their objective, is to minister to us. And the word sent forth in the Greek is in the continuous sense. They are continually being sent forth to minister to the heirs of salvation. The only limitation on the work of the angels is that they cannot force us to do the will of God. They can surround us with providence. They can put opportunities in our way. They can put us barriers in our way when we're doing the wrong thing. Remember Balaam? There was an angel standing in the way. But they cannot take away our free will. God must allow us to make our own choices. He will give us the opportunities. But we still have free will. And the only thing they cannot do is to force our free will. We have to make those decisions ourselves. Now, let's just come to Matthew 18 and just take an exhortation from that passage about individual angels. And I know I'm labouring this, but inevitably when the subject is raised, people say, well, yeah, it sounds good, but I just can't see the angel in my life. I just can't comprehend that an angel's got nothing better to do than to worry about me. Well, let me assure you, they have got nothing better to do than to worry about you. There are plenty of angels to move the nations into place. But angels enjoy the privilege of dealing with the life of a saint, because one of the things it does for them is it brings them in absolute frequent contact with the face of the Father. This is of great importance to God. And now that Christ is at his right hand, you can imagine the angels going and standing in the presence of God and saying, well, you gave me this Ron Carey to look after, but this is a pretty hard task. This is a real lemon, this job. You know, and the angels have got to go and to talk to God and to Christ about what they're trying to achieve. Matthew 18, verse 10. Now, the context is, don't despise little ones. Don't get so arrogant that you think you can trample upon the little ones that God has called. And so he says, take heed you despise not one of these little ones. For I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven. And the scene that's being painted by Christ is this, is that the angel goes back to heaven. You know, they ascend and descend from where the heirs of salvation are on the earth. And they go to heaven and they say, well, look, and you can see almost like 1 Kings 22. How are you going with that particular servant? Well, I tried this and I tried that and I was putting this circumstance ahead, but do you know what's happened today? Brother Smith in this ecclesia, he came across and he said this terrible thing. And he absolutely humiliated my servant that I'm trying to work with. And now he's all depressed. Oh. I better have a word to the angel that deals with Brother Smith. And that's the little scene that Jesus is painting here. He put in very if you like, very common terms. But you see, Jesus is saying that their angels go before the face of the Father to talk about the progress of the little one. And wouldn't it be terrible if you were mentioned as being the problem? Jesus says, don't despise my little ones, because your name might be mentioned in heaven in a rather unfortunate context. That's what Jesus is saying. That's got to be the power of that verse. Jesus saw very clearly how the angels work for the heirs of salvation. Now let's just go and look at the life of one man this morning. We might get time to go to another, but I want to just concentrate on one man. And we're going to look very much at what's already been covered, and that's the life of Jacob. So come back to Genesis 28, and we're going to take Jacob's life step by step, because he is the great archetype of the heirs of salvation who struggle in their life to really believe that God's angels work with them. I know this is a very familiar story, but I want you to see Jacob, because he teaches us to learn eventually to believe. And that's the problem we all have. We all know the theory. It takes a long time to really believe. Now, the life of Jacob. We're just going to ask you to run through Genesis with me on these particular contexts and look at what Jacob learns in his life about angels. Not only is Jacob's life one of the most fully recorded life, but the reason why it's so good as an example about angels is because it's easy to identify with. This is not a man that did everything right. This is not a man that always had the answers. This is a man that had a real problem with his natural tendencies. His mother was Assyrian, his uncle was Assyrian, and it took 40 years for God to knock the Syrian out of Jacob. Remember, he said, Isaac said, the voice is Jacob's, talking about Yahweh, as Brother Michael said, but the hands are the hands of Esau. The hands of deceit are the hands of Esau. The hands of the Syrian, the voice of the Syrian, his mother saying, obey my voice, obey my voice. Deceive your father. And the voice of the Syrian and the hands of the Esau were the problem that Jacob had all his life, and he had to learn to forsake that sort of thinking. The natural cunning of the Syrians. We can trick everybody. And for the rest of his life, and after he deceived his father, for the rest of his life, God put him in the hands of deceivers. Laban changed his wages 10 times. His own sons deceived him concerning Joseph. His wives deceived him concerning their little agreements amongst themselves, that he might learn not to be a Syrian. Well, it started in Genesis 28. We know that he's deceived his father. Now, the other reason that the life of Jacob is most interesting is all the tragedies that he had in his life. If you think about this, he was exiled. He never saw his mother again. She said, look, just go away for a few days until Esau cools down. He never saw her again. She was dead when he came back 40 years later. For 40 years he lived in mortal fear of Esau. And when he knew he was going to face Esau, he was absolutely petrified of what Esau would do to his family. When he was in the land, he lived in fear of the Canaanites. His sons went out and killed the men of Shechem in a most deceitful way. And he feared the revenge of the Canaanites. He was deceived by Laban concerning wives and wages. He was deceived by his wives in bitter conflict. He had in his family sons who committed incest, adultery, marriage out of the truth, who were about to murder Joseph. Sons who hated each other with a passion. Dinah was defiled at Shechem. You think your family's got problems? Try this for size. Rachel dies and leaves him with 2 boys, 5 and nothing, to bring up. Things go well for a couple of years, and then Joseph apparently is killed by a beast. His best son, the one that he put all his hopes in, is taken from his life. And then there's a famine that comes. And then Simeon gets caught in Egypt, locked up in jail. And he's got to send Benjamin. Do you know, Jacob got to a stage in his life when he said, all these things are against me. Nothing more could go wrong than what's gone wrong in my life. And that's a life in which the angels were totally at work. Let's just trace it. Genesis 28 and verse 13. The vision of the staircase. And I want you to really notice this, because it actually sets the tone of the life of Jacob. It took him the rest of his life to believe what was said to him here. The angel appears in verse he sees the vision, the angels ascending and descending. In other words, they were starting from the earth, reporting to heaven, coming back to him on earth. And it says in verse 13, and behold, Yahweh stood, and cross out above it, it's not correct, Yahweh stood by him, as the RV correctly has it. And it's exactly the same Hebrew that you read in Genesis 18 in verse 2, there stood by him three men. Yahweh stood by him. So Yahweh's in control of the angels that are going up and down, but he does not move. He's at the base of the staircase, and he's alongside of Jacob, and he says, just for confirmation, in verse 15, behold, I am with thee. So the mighty Yahweh angel, Michael, is there with Jacob. I will keep you wherever you go. I will not leave you. I mean, you can make a note of chapter 35 and verse 12. It says, when he came back to Bethel, and the covenant was renewed and reinforced to Jacob, it says, and God went up from him. The Elohim did leave him in Genesis 35 and verse 12, when he brought him back to the land. But he says, in the next 40 years, I won't leave you. Now, you can't get any clearer promise than that. But, you know, the time went by, and the vision dims. We have all the assurances of the Bible, but when we're out there in the daily grind of life and things are not going well, the promise doesn't seem quite so clear, does it? And that's what Jacob can teach us. Chapter 31. We're talking now 40 years later. I believe very firmly, and we could show you by chronology, that he was actually with Laban for 40 years. 20 years serving for his wives, and 20 years for the cattle. But take it from me that he was there 40 years. Okay, so at the end of 40 years, he's got all the goods of Laban, now he owns all of that, and the sons of Laban are getting pretty upset about the fact that Jacob's becoming pretty rich and they're getting poorer. And Jacob's been doing all these little tricks with, you know, the different ways of trying to interbreed the stock and putting up little willow rods and all of these things that he did, which he thought with his own cunning he was beating Laban. But the angel comes to him in a dream and he says, look, Jacob, I remember there's been no visitation for 40 years. And he comes in chapter 31 and verse 7. Let's just take it where it picks it up. Verse 5 to 7. Jacob says to his wives, I see your father's countenance, not towards me as before, but the God of my father hath been with me. So he's acknowledged that. Now, why did he acknowledge that? Well, what has happened, he says in verse 11, the angel of God spake to me in a dream, saying, Jacob, here am I. And you see, what had happened was in verse 11 and 12, the angel had come to him again and actually showed him in a dream that it wasn't his own devising that had got him the flocks of Laban, it was the work of Yahweh to affect the genetics of the flock. And so he says, I have seen in verse 12 all that Laban doeth unto thee. I am the Isle of Bethel. I told you I wouldn't leave you. I am the Isle of Bethel where you anointed the pillar and where you vowest a vow. Now arise and get you out of this land. So you see, the angel actually tells him that all the taking of Laban's flocks was the work of God, not the work of Jacob's cunning. But now, Jacob, the time is to go back to the land. And he calls him home. And Jacob acknowledged to his wives that God had actually given him everything. Verse 24, when he made his way, Laban pursues after him. And the night before Laban catches up with him in great anger, we read in verse 24, and Elohim came to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night. So again, the angels now, in a dream, warn Laban not to touch Jacob. And then we come to the dramatic incident in chapter 32, where Jacob is confronted by the angelic host. Now bear in mind, this was one of those very few occasions in the Bible. Genesis 32, Luke chapter 2, when the curtain of the invisible is drawn back. It often comes in times of insecurity, when men are actually allowed to see the whole angelic host. This is what David picked up in Psalm 34. Well, let's just look what happens. Now, remember Jacob, he's coming towards the land, and he's heard that Esau is coming to meet him. He's petrified what Esau might do. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. Isn't that interesting? They were actually there around him. They actually now front him up and they say, Jacob, stop here. We want to show you something. Have a look. You think you're alone. Have a look at this. And they opened up his vista, and all around him was the host of Yahweh. An enormous company. And he saw them and he said, this is God's host. This is God's army. God's encampment. And he made a big mistake. He called the name of the place Mahanaim, which means two camps or two armies. So there's my camp and there's God's camp. And he was wrong. God was trying to say, we're all one camp, Jacob. We're around you and it's one camp. He called the name of the place Mahanaim, two camps. David got it right in Psalm 34. The angel of Yahweh encamps, Mahanaim. Very similar word. He encamps around those that love and fear him. That's where he got it from. Two camps. But Jacob is still not trusting. You know, he's seen the angels, but he still doesn't believe. He still can't bring the fact together that the angels will deliver him from the hand of Esau. He still thinks it's up to him and his own devising to do something. And what does he do? In verse 3, he sends out his own angels. Look at verse 3. He sent messengers. Instead of trusting God's messengers, he says, well, I've got to go and appease Esau. And so he sends off spies and people to go and to talk to Esau to make sure it's all okay. You see, he doesn't trust, and the messengers come back. And human messengers always let you down. They did not get to talk to Esau. He said, you go and talk to Esau. They come back and they said, we saw him coming and he's got 400 men with him. They never ever got to find what Esau's attitude was. They just said, we saw 400 men, all of them armed. We're in big trouble. And if we don't trust the heavenly messenger, we think we send our own messengers out, we'll be in trouble. So Jacob, we read in verse 6, he was greatly afraid and distressed. Now later on he called this the day of his distress. Now he's really scared. Esau's got 400 powerful men with him. Incredible, isn't it? If you don't trust God, it doesn't get any better. So he thinks, well, I've got to do something. So I'll divide my company into two bands. Mahanaim again. Two companies. I've got to make it into three groups now. So, you see, he's got it wrong totally. And he thinks, well, if Esau hits this one, then the others will get away. And then he gives this glorious prayer, which is full of wonderful allusions to God, but still not fully in faith. All he can see, look, you read verse 11. When you read it in the Hebrew, it's very dramatic and very graphic. He says, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. Oh, he was very glad to have the hands of Esau a little while ago, wasn't he? Remember what Isaac said? The voice is Jacob's, but the hands are the hands of Esau. Let me feel, you really are Esau, aren't you? Oh yes, I'm Esau. And now he's saying, deliver me from the hands of Esau. See how God brings the wheel round upon people that they might learn the lessons of life? Deliver me from the hand of Esau. For I fear him, lest he will come and smite me. And the mother with the children, and the margins got quite ripped, the mother upon the children. I can see Esau carving up my little children in bits, and then the mother's on top of them. And a great pile of meat of my family. And that's the vision in Jacob's mind, not the vision of the angels. And you see, he's obsessed with his fear. And he calls upon God's promises. Glorious prayer in many ways. But is he trusting? No. Look what happens in verse 13. He lodged there and took of that which came to his hand, a present for his Esau. And he starts doing all this dividing up of animals, sending out droves of animals that he might appease Esau. Incredible, brethren and sisters. So much self-motivated cunning to try and appease Esau. You know, verse 20 is absolutely dramatic in the Hebrew. Let me read it to you from the literal Hebrew. This is what Jacob is thinking. This is his attitude, despite having seen the angels. He says this, and this is what the servants had to say, behold, thy servant Jacob is behind us. And here's what's going on in his head. This is the Bible telling us, this is the thinking of Jacob. For I will cover his face with the present that goes before my face, and afterward I will see his face, and peradventure he will accept my face. That's the literal Hebrew of that verse. It's all about the face of Jacob and Esau. And the last time he saw Esau's face, it was contorted with anger and says, "You're dead, brother, you're dead." And he can still see that angry face. And he said, "If I send all these gifts, that he might look at my face and might even smile." And you see, he's absolutely concerned with the face of Esau. "I will appease his face and he will see my face." And it's all about faces. What did he call the place after he fought with the angel? The faces of God. The face of the Elohim. That's what he called the place. And the angel got hold of him and said, "Jacob, I've been telling you I will never leave you. I've been with you for 40 years. I've got an army on my side. Look at my face." And when you're wrestling with somebody, you're probably closer to somebody's face for any other experience of life, except perhaps for those who are in love. When you're wrestling with somebody, you're agonizing with face to face as you're gripping and looking into their eyes. And the angel said, "Don't look at Esau, look at my face." And so the angel wrestles with him, and we find in verse 24, and Jacob was left alone. Finally he's alone. He sent all his cunning ahead of him, and he's still trying to find God. And there wrestled a man with him to the breaking of the day. We know it was an angel. Hosea tells us it was an angel. And all through the night, the angel makes Jacob exert himself. Now the angel could have, as we know the angel later did, just go bang and he's lame. Could have made him dead any minute of the night. It wasn't the angel didn't have the strength. The angel exerted maximum influence to make him fight hard. "Hang on to me." And the whole point was, the angel was wrestling to get away. Look what happens. He touches Jacob's thigh. He actually now makes him lame. A wound in the flesh, a thorn in the flesh, that he might learn to trust in God, that the excellency might be of God, the power might be of God and not of men. And the angel says in verse 26, "Let me go, for the day breaks." And he invites Jacob to let go his grip. You see, the fight's been about, the angel was there, and Jacob latches onto him and says, "I need your help." And he says, "Let me go, let me go." And all night he's wrestling to go. And he's saying to Jacob, "Are you going to hang on, or are you going to trust in yourself?" Jacob, the sun's coming up. Esau's coming. You better get out and, you know, invent a few more little tricks. And at last he gets the point. "I will not let thee go except you bless me. I'll hang on. Even though I'm lame, I'll still hang on to the angel. I want you to promise me it's going to be all right." "Ah, good. What's your name?" You see, you've matured, Jacob. "What's your name?" "I'm the supplanter. The heel catcher. That's always been worried about Esau." "Well, at last you've learned. Now you're going to be a prince with God. A prince with God. Because you've had power with the Elohim and you've prevailed. You've at last realized to put more trust in me than worrying about Esau." And Jacob says, "Well, what's your name?" He said, "Don't ask after my name. It's not important. I'm going to bless you." And then, in verse 30, Jacob called the name of the place Faces of God, Peniel, "For I have seen Elohim face to face, and my life is preserved. And I've been staring into the face of an angel." And very calmly, he couldn't now run anyway, very calmly, Jacob walked on. And when he got there, there's the wives and the children and Esau with his arms open to embrace him. "When a man's ways please Yahweh," says the proverb. In 16 and verse 7, "When a man's ways please Yahweh, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him." And the angel had gone before, appeased the face of Esau, and he welcomed Jacob with open arms. "My brother, good to see you." And you see, he put his trust in the right place. Chapter 35 and verse 9. The angel now completes the cycle. They came to the oak of Bethel after more tribulations, more sufferings. Verse 9, God appeared unto Jacob again, and he blessed him and gave him the promise to Abraham. And then in verse 13, he went up from the place where he had talked with him. And after 40 years or more, the cycle was over. Jacob come back to Bethel, purged his house. The angel reinforced the promise and left him just for a time. And there were no more appearances to Jacob of angels for the next 33 years. Until the great events concerning Joseph. Come to Genesis 48 and verse 15. You know, Jacob was to go through the most incredible sufferings over the next 33 years. The sins of his sons, the loss of Joseph, apparent loss of Simeon, the impending loss of Benjamin. Tremendous pressures upon Jacob. But when it was all over and God had brought him through it, notice the comment of maturity in Genesis 48 and verse 15. He blessed Joseph and said, Elohim, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac did walk. And the word in Hebrew means before whom they habitually walked. The God which shepherded me as it should be. All my life long unto this day. The angel. See, that's the Elohim. He's obviously talking about God. But he saw the angel now as the personal representative of God. The angel which redeemed me from all evil. Bless the lads. Now, just notice, brethren and sisters, he says, the angel redeemed me from all evil. And given the list that I gave you about the evil that came upon Jacob, in what sense do we read that? Well, he'd brought him through. You know, he said to Pharaoh, few and evil have been the days of the years of my life. All things are against me. But now, as he's come to supreme faith, he says, the angel brought me through all that evil. Not away from it. I wasn't spared a lot of evil, but I've been brought through to the end of my life. And now I've got Joseph and I've got all my sons around my feet. You see, there's faith, brethren and sisters, and you know, that's the one thing in the life of Jacob, apart from his pilgrim life, that's the one thing that makes it into Hebrews chapter 11. It says, by faith Jacob blessed the sons of Joseph, leaning upon his bed. And that's the words that he said, because verse 14 is about blessing the sons of Joseph. What did he bless them with? The wish that the same angel that had been mighty in his life and in Abraham and Isaac's life would go with those lads. Because it ends up, that angel blessed the lads. See, here's what makes Hebrews chapter 11. Faith that's come through the fire. Faith that's now really believing in the angel. And so Jacob died with that great confession of faith. So let's take some lessons from that. You know, he said, few and evil have been the days of my life. None of us have really suffered what Jacob has been through. But we have it in measure. Brother Roberts makes some beautiful comments about Jacob and the ways of providence. Trouble is often a preparation for good, even now. God may be at work in our affairs, not only when there is no trace of his hand. You think of Jacob. He could not even see that God could be at work in all these terrible things. But when it seems impossible he can be at work, it may often seem that God is not working with us, but he may be working against us. And I would guess in most people's life, there's a stage when they come to, like Job's wife, curse God and die. God doesn't care about us. He's left us to put up with all these things that are too much. Sometimes he even seems to be working against us. And so Brother Roberts goes on to say, commenting on Jacob, the very best experience is only a state of divinely regulated evil. There are evils in the world. The curse is in place. Things will go wrong. Mortality and the proneness to sin will lead to disasters in life. But remember, blessedness might be just around the corner. God can work out of the most frightening situations, most sad situations, good. The divine regulation of this may and does permit the experience of evil in severe forms by his people. Some of Jacob's experiences, however, show that the cruelest and apparently most aimless wretch of affliction may be but the preparation for the highest blessedness even now. And even in this life, Jacob came to realize that what he'd been put through and his family had gone through had achieved many things. He couldn't bring Rachel back from the grave. He couldn't undo the sufferings that Joseph had to go through, the tears and the crying from the pit, the misery in the prison. He couldn't undo any of that. But in the end, God had worked mightily, even in this age. And who knows what God has worked eternally. And brethren and sisters, we have to realize that our struggles may soon be over. And we will come to the time when God says he will wipe away all tears from off their faces. And we will see and we will comprehend the great things that God has done. What we have to do is to learn to trust that God is concerned enough with our lives. And this very beautiful summary of Jacob, I think, actually makes us realize how often we must be frustrating to the angels. There are many Jacobs in the service of God today, men who have received clear, gracious, divine assurances of the forgiveness of sins. It's sad to find people that have, the Bible says, repent, confess, and God will forgive. He's abundantly pardoning people. And you run into people to say, well, God can't forgive me. We've received that assurance of unfailing heavenly care and guidance, of ceaseless angelic concern for all their affairs. And yet they live as though convinced that their own wit and wisdom and scheming and contriving are worth more than anything the heavenly minister can do. It is enough to make angels weep with disappointment. And how it must be frustrating for them sometimes, brethren and sisters, if we don't make progress. We need to clearly understand what providence is. Because you will hear in the Brotherhood extremes in both directions. There are some people who are so fatalistic that believe it's really up to us to get salvation, that it's what we can do, and we've got to order our life, we've got to make sure we're secure in this life, we've got all our pension worked out, and we've got our superannuation worked out. You know, we've got to look after ourselves. You know, God says you've got to be good stewards, you know, you've got to serve diligently while we're in this life, and all those things are true. But some people have got it all worked out according to human wisdom, and God's not in the picture. There are others that see providence in all kinds of things that God's not concerned with. You know, it makes me creep to hear people say, well, we put our house on the market, if it sells for this price, then we know that God wants us to move. And I think of all the servants of God that he's called in bamboo huts that get blown away in cyclones. And I don't think God's particularly concerned whether we get $100,000 or $105,000 for our house. Brethren and sisters, let's not bring God into things of which he says he won't be interested. Let's not overlook for providence. You know, there are certain areas that God says he is concerned about. He makes these promises. Seek ye first the kingdom of God. You make that a priority in your life and see if God doesn't help you. Trust in Yahweh with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding. That's Jacob, isn't it? In all thy ways acknowledge him. And he shall direct thy paths. If we are making our paths what we can understand from the Bible to be the paths of truth, if we dedicate ourselves to doing what God wants to be done, he says, I will direct your path. You've got to depart from evil. You've got to take the right steps so that God can work with you. But you've got to trust. Remember the friends of Daniel? When they were threatened with the fiery furnace, they said, look, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us. And we hope that he will deliver us. But if he doesn't, we aren't going to worship your idol. You see, they had a correct understanding of providence. God has the power. We believe that God has the intention. But we're not going to make God do what we want to do. We'll do the right thing. And in the end, whether or not we die or whether we live, in the end, it'll be the right thing by God. So don't waste your time trying to work out whether this is providence, whether or not the traffic lights on the way to the meeting were providence. Don't get Pentecostal about it. But brethren and sisters, let's trust that God is working them and to learn to do the things that will enable them to work. Abraham will teach his children. The angel said, because he wants to teach his children, I will give him extra information, because I know that he'll use it right in his family. Because Daniel and his friends trusted in God, the angel came to deliver them. We have to play our part. And God says there are two areas that we can be absolutely sure he will help us with. Our ultimate spiritual well-being. He wants us in the kingdom. So God says, I will work on your salvation. Notice we have to walk in his path to achieve that. The other thing is we do the things that God says he wants done. Like he wants the truth preached in all lands. I believe God greatly supports the work of the mission fields, because people are out there with their feet proclaiming the gospel of peace, and God can work with them. God wants us to feed his sheep in the ecclesias. He wants us to grow in spirituality. He wants us to raise God's heritage. He will direct our paths if we set our hearts to do those things. But we have to take some action. Brother Roberts again, though God is with his children, he looks to them to arrange their affairs with discretion, as testified in all the Proverbs of Solomon. Human action is the basis for divine supervision. We can't just sit around and say, well, come on, angels, do something for me. We've got to take some action so that God and his angels can work with us. In the absence of human action, there is nothing for the angels to work on. So, brothers and sisters, let us take the advice that Brother Roberts gives us once again in the ways of providence concerning Jacob. Jacob illustrates plainly the angelic nature of what we call providence, giving affairs an intelligent bent this way or that without showing their hand. Where angels do not operate, providence is not at work. Not everything that happens in life is angelic interference. There is a course of nature, there is chance, there is coincidence. But the angels can steer those things when God's plan requires it. Angelic operations in ordinary life are not distinguishable from the effect of nature, the results being natural. Our part is to fear God and keep the commandments, and go forth with courage and trust, believing the assurance that all things work together for good for those who love God. Brethren and sisters, when we do that, the angels rejoice in heaven.